Dan Diamond, you're leaving us.
Jeremy, all good things must come to an end. And by that, I mean our weekly check-ins. I don't know what I'll do every Wednesday moving forward.
Well, I've got a little parting gift for you. I thought, what better way to celebrate you than with a little piece of audio?
I'm emotionally bracing myself for this.
You should be.
Handlebar mustache. Politico dispatch.
Who's singing?
Me.
Whose favorite show's The Bachelorette?
My favorite guess show held is
scoops
not
no one else can get. Goodbye, Dan Diamond.
Oh my god.
Talking with him was the best time, man. He's going to the Washington Post, and I think I'm gonna miss him the most, so goodbye, Dan Diamond.
Oh my god. Oh my god. So two things. One, your talents are clearly wasted producing a podcast and not bidding for American Idol. Second, I'm really touched. Thank you.
Oh, I'm glad you are. Yeah, so that's it. I think we can end the show here. That's as good as we can do.
I would be fine with that. Just play that on repeat for 20 minutes.
Hello, Pulse Check listeners. This is Dan Diamond, coming to you for the last time on this show with another episode of our special Pulse Check series on the coronavirus outbreak. Today, I'm in conversation with my great colleague and friend, Jeremy Siegel, from our daily Dispatch podcast, looking at the past 5 years of health policy and politics, tracing it to today's coronavirus response, and touching on some of the highlights of my time at Politico. Here is that wistful conversation.
It's been 5 years since you joined Politico and started covering health policy and politics in Washington. Yesterday was literally your 5-year anniversary at Politico. And I want to talk about some of the highlights of your career here and the biggest stories you've tracked over the years. But first, we are in a unique moment in U.S. history right now, a confusing one. The nation's reeling from a deadly siege on the U.S. Capitol by supporters of President Trump. Lawmakers are working right now to remove Trump from office as we speak. As someone who's covered Trump for the past 4 years, how are you making sense of this moment?
I got an email from someone inside the White House on Wednesday morning saying, essentially, this is not how I thought this was going to end.
Mr. Speaker, we are debating this historic measure at an actual crime scene. And we wouldn't be here if it weren't for the President of the United States.
We know that we faced enemies of the Constitution. We know we experienced the insurrection that violated the sanctity of the people's capital and attempted to overturn the duly recorded will of the American people.
On Wednesday, January 6th, Congress gathered here to fulfill our constitutional duty. But at a rally just a mile and a half down Pennsylvania Avenue, Donald Trump and his allies were stoking the anger of a violent mob.
Democrats are going to impeach President Trump again. This doesn't unite the country. There's no way this helps the nation deal with the tragic and terrible events of last week that we all condemn.
Is there little time left? Yes. But it is never too late to do the right thing.
And I don't know, Jeremy, I thought some version of this was always plausible, where the nation was facing a crisis, where Democrats desperately wanted him gone, where many congressional Republicans who never liked Trump were rooting for his departure too. I don't cover justice or international diplomacy, so some of the president's offenses that led to previous crises or this one are beyond my scope as a health reporter. But I did always try and take Trump's actions on healthcare seriously, and that goes back to that summer of 2015 when he had announced his run for president. And I wrote a piece at Forbes where I remember I was emailing with a previously unknown spokesperson named Hope Hicks about what Donald Trump believed on healthcare, what he was going to try and do, and why his bold proclamations didn't match up with reality. And I do think his push from day one to overturn the Affordable Care Act.
I will ask Congress to convene a special session so we can repeal and replace.
Was cynical and based in untruths or even lies about what he was going to give Americans in return.
Obamacare has to be replaced, and we will do it, and we will do it very, very quickly. It is a catastrophe.
Tens of millions of Americans depended on the ACA, still depend on it for coverage and for its protections. President Trump never really put in the work to understand it, and Republicans never came up with a plan to adequately replace it. And it was that kind of leadership that I thought predicted so much of what is to come. And you mentioned my favorite TV show, The Bachelorette, which it is not. But do you watch the show Arrested Development? Have you ever seen that show?
I do. Yeah, I watched all of it. Multiple times, actually.
Amazing TV show. That one I might put on my short list. But I remember during the ACA repeal fight, this must have been early 2017, I was sitting on my couch at night, and I was thinking about how cynical and shallow the whole Obamacare repeal effort was, how it was based on this lie about what Republicans were going to bring in its place. And it reminded me of the show Arrested Development, and specifically how the character Job was promising to build a house really fast. Mm-hmm. This is like an early episode.
As I told my brother, the president, if we start construction on a second model home, we can be cutting this ribbon within 2 months.
And I said, that's why you're no longer president. 2 weeks. Let's do it in 2 weeks. Hey!
So what they end up doing, to spoil the episode, they build like the frame of a house, and they hold a whole celebration, sort of like a rose garden ceremony, perhaps.
Ladies and gentlemen, I present to you phase two of the Bluth Company, a house truly solid as a rock.
To commemorate that this shell house has been built, and for a second it looks like they're going to pull it all off, and then the house collapses. And I remember sitting on my couch thinking about that and just tweeted some of that out, and it really blew up. It got written up by Entertainment Weekly. It got a shout out in the New York Times. In retrospect, I didn't ask anyone at Politico whether I should do it. But from the jump, I did think President Trump and his team were putting politics in front of policy, and often in front of the American people. So that's a roundabout way of saying that I thought the Trump administration era was one where the problems were apparent from the beginning. I guess the surprise is it took until the last week for so many Republicans to willingly turn on him and want him out too.
All right, I want to go back through some of the biggest health stories you've covered over the past few years. The first one I'm looking at predates the coronavirus pandemic. You broke the story on how HHS Secretary Tom Price was routinely taking extravagant flights, wasting taxpayer money. This was a couple years ago. It almost sounds a little quaint now compared to what's going on in Washington now. But tell me how you broke this story and what you think it revealed at the time about the Trump administration and its health team and the way it works.
So on the Tom Price story, which we broke in September 2017, and first, I should say, Rachna Pradhan, who's now at Kaiser Health News, she got the first tip. I will always remember her looking across our shared desk and her saying to me, have you heard about Tom Price taking private jets? And he was the HHS secretary at that point for only a few months. It was very hard to get a handle on the administration. We weren't getting responses to some of our most basic questions. We weren't being told where the secretary was going ahead of time. But I can say that the genesis of the Tom Price story goes back to the day that James Comey, the FBI director who was fired by President Trump early in his tenure, James Comey had been fired. And Kellyanne Conway, the president's advisor, did a briefing in front of the White House. She was doing TV hits.
Kellyanne, to those who say, why now? Why fire James Comey now? What do you say?
Well, I would point them to the three letters that were received today. Anderson, the letter by President Donald Trump, the letter by Attorney General Sessions.
And what was very weird to both Rachna and I was Kellyanne Conway had been with Tom Price, the HHS secretary, in West Virginia for an event really just a couple hours before. But the fact that Kellyanne Conway had almost magically gone from West Virginia to the West Wing in the span of a few hours, it was a little weird. And I remember us both thinking, as we compared notes, how did she get back to the White House so fast? But we didn't put two and two together until after Rachna's tip. And we both were able to get to the same place pretty quickly, that there were rumors, rumblings of Price spending hundreds of thousands of dollars in total on these charter jets. We ended up camping out at airports, trying to catch Price in the act to get confirmation of these rumors. It's a lot to accuse a cabinet secretary of misspending hundreds of thousands of dollars. We needed to see it for ourselves. So one morning, one early morning, we drove out to Dulles and tried to camp out there. We knew vaguely where he'd be coming from. We got there, kind of had the wrong vantage point to see what was going on the tarmac. There were some nervous moments where Rach and I were on different sides trying to look into the tarmac from different positions. There was some hasty head and eye movement from 100 yards away where we were trying to communicate through visual signals and, of course, got it all wrong. So we blew it a bit in the morning when Price and Kellyanne Conway were flying up from Dulles outside of Washington, D.C. to Philadelphia. But we used that experience to get a better sense of where we needed to be to see Price when he returned later that day. And through a variety of ways, we kept tabs on what he was doing in Philadelphia. We got into position for his return. Rachna got in her car to do a drive-by viewing of the tarmac. We figured that that was going to be the best way to do it. I went to the main terminal where I could track the flights in and out. I had the best view. And the two of us working together were able to get positive confirmation. Rachna saw Price coming out of the plane. I ran down and saw the SUVs pulling away and believed I saw Kellyanne Conway through a window. And it still took, after that, a few days of confirmation, nervously meeting up with sources to get to a point where we're able to publish the story.
Secretary of Health and Human Services Tom Price has offered his resignation, and President Donald Trump has accepted that resignation. Price has been under fire for his use of chartered aircraft, as many as 26 private flights. That's according to Politico.
And within about 10 days of publishing that first story on Tom Price and his use of charter jets at taxpayer expense, Price was pushed out by Trump, who was already angry at Price for a bunch of reasons, including the failure to repeal the ACA. He put some of the blame on the secretary.
It's amazing hearing you talking about reporting this story and sort of like the physicality of it all. I mean, you like making symbols with your hands and body, being at an airport, tracking this story, meeting with sources day in and day out. And then, I mean, flash forwarding to now, in the middle of a global pandemic, you're still breaking major stories that have had, you know, similar effects in Washington. But things are obviously really different. I mean, you and I are talking over Zoom right now. I'm guessing you're mostly communicating with sources over the phone, over text, over Zoom, or whatever. What's it been like reporting on the coronavirus pandemic? And how does it compare to, you know, your previous years at Politico breaking stories?
It's wildly different for all the reasons you suggest. I can't do the secret meetups in the various places that I used to like to do. Just meeting outside is fraught to begin with when you're meeting with some senior people. The idea of doing it in the middle of a pandemic raises the stakes. At the same time, people are in some ways really accessible because for the most part, I know they're in front of computers too. So there are folks who might otherwise have been in meetings with 15, 20 people and couldn't step out to talk to me. Now they're virtually connecting to a meeting from their apartment or house or office because people are trying not to get together, and it makes it that much easier to track someone down. And then I just think the pandemic itself has focused a lot of the work. We had covered the agencies, the health department, pretty deeply for a few years. I mean, that Tom Price story was notable in part because it was the first real glimpse into the tensions inside HHS. When Price was ousted, his allies were furious at Medicaid chief Seema Verma. They were convinced that she had engineered his exit. And that laid the groundwork for a lot of fights inside HHS dating up to and through the pandemic. So I think so many of the stories that seemed like one-off even a few years ago helped shed light on how the Trump administration responded to COVID-19.
All right, we're going to take a quick break here, and we'll be back in a minute after a message from our sponsor. We've talked a bunch on this show about some of the stories you've broken on the pandemic, and we'll link to them in the episode notes here. But I want to talk to you about one story you broke recently that we haven't talked about, because I think it sort of, you know, hints at some of the inner issues in the Trump administration and even what we're seeing right now with impeachment and what we saw last week. And I'm just going to read the headline here, and I want you to tell me the backstory to it. Here's the headline. "We want them infected. Trump appointee demanded, quote, herd immunity strategy. Emails reveal." That's just a wild headline. What happened here, and what does it tell us about the Trump administration?
That email was written by Paul Alexander, the scientific advisor in the HHS Public Affairs Shop, a friend of Michael Caputo, the spokesperson who was installed at the health department by Donald Trump himself. We've talked quite a bit, I think, about Paul Alexander, Michael Caputo on this podcast, but to quickly catch folks up, Caputo was a longtime friend of the president. The president put him in the health department essentially to carry out Trump's message, and Caputo brought in his friend Alexander, who, not a doctor himself, but Caputo used him to essentially declare war on the doctors at the CDC and people like Tony Fauci. Sarah Overmall, my colleague at Politico, had gotten some evidence of Paul Alexander bullying Tony Fauci, the revered infectious disease expert. Paul Alexander didn't want Fauci to talk about the risks of coronavirus to kids. Now, independently, I was also writing on Alexander. There were a lot of things that Paul Alexander was doing that were raising red flags. And when Sarah got copies of Alexander emailing Tony Fauci, that inspired me to work harder to get copies of my own version of the story, where Paul Alexander was pestering and bullying the CDC. Politico's investigation prompted Democrats to open their own probe into Paul Alexander, Caputo, and other officials who might have been involved in political interference. And that email, where Alexander was arguing for deliberate infections, saying that that was a strategy to contain COVID, that was an email he sent to senior officials at the health department.
Here's one of his emails from July 4th, Paul Alexander sending an email advocating for the government to follow what they call a herd immunity strategy. Quote, "Infants, kids, teens, young people, young adults, middle-aged with no conditions have zero to little risk. We use them to develop herd. We want them infected."
He got a reception from people like Caputo, who didn't shout him down, who wanted, if anything, more evidence for the strategy.
He misspells a lot of things, but he got that one actually right. We want them infected. It's a senior advisor at HHS saying, let's get as many kids infected as we can, and the middle-aged too.
It was not, Jeremy, from everything I've been able to uncover, it was not the defining strategy of the health department. There's nothing that I see where Alex Azar, the health secretary, took this advice and made it his own. But the fact that this strain of thinking existed in the administration and was tolerated because it was seen to come from allies of Trump, I think it shows just how dysfunctional the federal government's own attempts to control COVID were, that there were people at the highest levels of government able to make these arguments and have them heard and considered.
Looking back at all of your coverage of the Trump administration before the pandemic, its response to the pandemic, the controversies and problems within top agencies that you're talking about, how would you say it all has led to the moment we're in today? I mean, not just with the pandemic, but also with impeachment, with the Democratic crisis we've seen over the past week. Like, do you see a through line in what you've reported on for Politico over the years?
I do. And again, I'm a health reporter. I'm not someone who writes about national security. I'm not a White House reporter. But the federal government has been under assault by many Trump appointees for years. There were efforts by Trump appointees at the health department to roll back protections for patients. Federal employees, civil servants, tried to stop them, slow them, just giving further credence to the belief by Trump and his supporters that there's a deep state in Washington. There were efforts by Trump appointees to do away with scientific programs. I wrote recently, revisiting earlier disputes, I wrote recently about the effort to end the teen pregnancy prevention program back in 2017. This was a program that seemed to have bipartisan support. There was some evidence that I was working to curb pregnancy among teens, which is a common public health goal. And yet, some Trump appointees in the health department really wanted this gone. And there were supporters of the president in the religious community, in the anti-abortion movement, who wanted to see this program done away with, too. To get from teen pregnancy prevention to COVID-19 does take a few steps, but those sorts of fights that were going on inside the health department wore people down. It drove career officials out. So when COVID-19 arrived a few years later, HHS was more vulnerable than it had been in previous administrations. It had already been through all these battles and frays and fights that left staff not trusting each other, not trusting political appointees, and not always sharing the same vision of what public health should look like.
Do you think the coronavirus pandemic is the biggest story you'll ever cover in your career?
There was a moment in 2012, so almost a decade ago, when economist Austin Fracht and I discovered a Twitter glitch where essentially Twitter users weren't able to see some replies that were being sent. I don't know how many people saw the blog post, saw the coverage of that, tens of thousands maybe. I remember seeing some data that someone from Tibet had read the story. And at the time, I remember thinking that that was the biggest thing I'd ever do in my life, that some person in Tibet was reading this thing on Twitter. COVID feels like the biggest thing. I mean, it's changed all of our lives. This is a time when health reporters are forefront in journalism, and when people like Ashish Jha and Lena Wen, who I've interviewed or known for years, they're household names because they're on TV all the time. But I don't know. I mean, careers can take all kinds of windy, twisty turns. So perhaps this will be the biggest story. And if it is, I hope I'm covering it well. And perhaps it will be another story that we can't even imagine now. So I'm just trying to stay focused on reporting this one out and seeing what comes next.
I want to talk about another story that you've done, branching away from the coronavirus here. Over the years, you've done some important reporting on vulnerable populations and their access to healthcare. And again, we'll link to all of that coverage here in the show notes. But I want to zoom in on one particular story about Native Marshall Islanders, citizens of the Pacific Island chain left riddled with radiation after U.S. nuclear testing, and their fight for access to health care and your coverage of it. How did you begin working on this story, and how have you seen it evolve over the years while at Politico?
That series of stories on the Pacific Islanders, on the Marshallese who were barred from Medicaid, it truly came out of a chance encounter. I went down to the U.S. Capitol in February 2019, so almost 2 years ago. I went down there to cover the unveiling of Democrats' Medicare for All bill in the House.
It is time to ensure that health care is a right and not a privilege guaranteed to every person in our country. It is time for Medicare for All.
And the event was held outside. There was a rally. I was walking around the periphery of the rally, just asking people why they were there. Wasn't sure I was going to use it for a story. Just curious what would bring people to a rally on Medicare for All. And I ran into two health workers from Iowa who said they weren't there for the rally. They were there for a different meeting in Washington. They happened to be walking by, but they were moved by the message.
To be honest, we didn't know that this rally was going on.
Oh, wow.
Until today. And then we're like, since we're here and we're up here, we need to come.
Because they worked with Marshallese patients who had been barred from Medicaid for decades and had been dealing with the fallout, literal fallout, the nuclear fallout from U.S. military testing on their homeland, as well as the inability to get health coverage.
All they eat is Spam and rice because that's all we've ever shipped to them. So they're overweight, diabetic, high blood pressure, kidney disease. They can't eat any fruits and vegetables, can't eat the fish that they normally would eat.
Greater is your cancers.
So what you're saying is the United States has ruined their lives, essentially.
Correct.
Basically.
And
correct.
Not found any way to make it right.
Correct.
And Medicare for All would do that.
Yes. That's what our hope is, yeah.
they were sick, they were unable to have their health care paid for. It just sounded like a horrible, horrible situation. And it was something that I had never heard of before. I've been writing and researching healthcare for years, over 10 years, and this is not an issue that I'd ever been aware of. It stuck in my head, and I started asking questions in Washington. I talked to some congressional advocates. I met with some lawmakers and their staffs, and it became clear that this was a problem that felt morally wrong, but also a problem that felt fixable with the right spotlight. And I did believe that Politico could play a role in spotlighting this issue. So I went to Iowa, where I got to spend time with those health workers, the pharmacist Heather Rickardson, someone that I kept in touch with a lot over the next year. And I reported on this problem in a way that it got the attention of Congress. And Congress moved through the efforts of a lot of people, well beyond any of the stories I did. There were advocates who have been fighting this fight for years. But Congress moved across 2020 to finally fix this Medicaid glitch that had barred the Marshallese ever since the mid-90s. It was certainly a rewarding way to end a very hard year. And I know that the Marshallese are now finally getting enrolled in Medicaid for the first time since the 1990s. So that's a story that I plan to continue to follow. All right, that is our show. I'm Dan Diamond, and my thanks to my colleague Jeremy Siegel for joining me this week, as he's done so many weeks this past year. Adam Kankren, Sarah Overmall, Darius Tahir, Rachel Rubin, Brianna Ailey, Joanne Kennan, Carrie Budoff Brown, Alice Miranda Olstein, David Lim, Paul Demko, and so many other Politico colleagues who join me for conversations, and the various senators, prominent officials, thinkers, that they came on Pulse Check as well. Jenny Ament is the senior producer of the show. Irene Noguchi is our executive producer. I'm Dan Diamond. Thanks for listening. And if I don't talk to you soon, stay safe through the pandemic.